All right. We are here with Dr. Mark Goslin, the head of cardiopulmonary imaging at Vision Radiology. He is a retired full professor from Oregon Health and Science University and previously was the program director at the University of Utah's radiology program. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Before we get started, do you have any financial disclosures?
I have no financial disclosures.
Daniel did a nice little intro giving a potted bio, but in your own words, like when you're telling people about your path in medicine, what do you tell people?
The path was a very fortunate one, actually. And that's what I think. I was lucky enough to get to go to medical school up in Montreal at McGill. They take 10% Americans. I was lucky to get in. And it was an amazing 4 years there. And the learning was off the chart. I did my family practice up at the Arctic Circle for 6 weeks, had my own clinic, delivered a bunch of babies, come back. The whole fourth year is something what you guys call an acting internship here. Well, that was our entire fourth year. And then the last 4 months, you go back into the classroom and you relearn the anatomy head to toe again, nutrition, epidemiology, and pathology. These were considered the core principles that you had to know. And then I even got ACLS and ATLS certified, you know, and then you're out. So then from there, just the decision to go into radiology was a tough one because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I kind of liked everything. And what ended up happening was I started to notice that it was a privilege to look inside people, not so much with the surgical, but just the whole person. And that I still feel today when I give lectures, it's like, it's a privilege what we do and what we can learn from that. And so I went through the years and then to Stanford for my fellowship. And that was another fantastic fellowship year. But what I found was that my real learning and was my first couple of years as faculty. That's when I started to sit down with students trying to figure out my new role as faculty. And they would say, hey, you know, what's that on the radiograph? And I would go, I don't know. And what's this? I don't know. And you start to realize, God, did I do a fellowship in this? Oh, my God. I mean, how are people who do ICU and ER and surgery, how do they deal with this? You know? And that's where the real learning became. And that's when I started to really have an interest in things like medical mythology and dogma. Because I started to see inside where what I got taught and what we got taught isn't necessarily true. And if that's not true, well, what else isn't true? And that's what started to really pique my interest. So that was that's where it really kind of took off. And then for the next like 10 or so years, I was just loving it. I mean, I was seeing things and writing about things that we visualized, wrote about transient eruption of contrast. I saw that one day and I said, hey, I don't think this has ever been described, you know. But in the end, the medical system started to change a bit. The academics changed a bit, became very administrative heavy. And then towards the end, last 5 years at OHSU, they were rough. You would give recommendations to, say, a physician that you're pretty sure about, and they would ignore it. They would do what they want. And you started to witness things that you didn't think necessarily might be in the patient's best interest, but they would do it anyway. And I started to wonder, like, why was I feeling like I was almost like drunk driving home after? I just felt exhausted. And I would get really down on the Sunday night before coming back into work. And these were all red flags that I kind of ignored. And it wasn't until I read an article by Richard Gunderman, and he basically said burnout was not working long hours. Because I remember when I was a resident, I would do 36-hour shifts. And then at the end of it, I would go to the track and do intervals. I was so pumped. Because I felt like I really did something. We did a lot. I started to feel that Gundermann's description was this, that it's thousands and thousands of minute betrayals of purpose, of why you're there. And you start to realize that you've worked hard, you're doing your best, but it just gets ignored, or, you know, they just go do what they want anyway. And then you start to wonder, like, why am I here? Like, I'd start to get pages from the ER, have this read. I read it, and then I start to realize, you know, God, I feel like I'm a litigation buffer for ER at this point. I mean, they're not really, you know, listening too much to what I say. Some do, but a number didn't. And you never really kind of get that, you know, thanks a lot or stuff like that. And after a while, I just said, I got to go, you know. And so I made the transition from, after 20 years of cardiopulmonary, I went to the general in Vision Radiology, which, you know, is a wonderful group. It's a group of, a lot of us are ex-academicians, and we just didn't want to do it anymore. So that's kind of the journey where I'm at. And now this is what I do. I still lecture a lot. I enjoy it. I enjoy sharing the information. Hopefully most of it's correct. If it's not, I change it. I get to still meet a lot of different people. I still lecture at the medical school, mostly on transition to, you know, residency, what they need to do. Like, when you read articles, don't read just from your own specialty. That's a sure way of propagating a medical myth or a dogma. Read it from a different point of view. Maybe it's right, maybe it's not, maybe it's partially right. You know, try to be curious, all of these things. And I've really enjoyed that. I've also been, had the wonderful honor while I was at OHSU, where, God, it was like, I think 9 out of 10 years, I got elected as teacher of the year. And I was a commencement speaker at their, at the faculty commencement speech, 4 out of 5 years. And that was something different. And so I've had a lot of wonderful experiences. I look back with fondness mostly, and I try not to dwell on the things that kind of brought me down. But I did find that it took a number of years to kind of get over this. I left in 2016. These are going to be things that you'll probably encounter, all of the people who, whatever they do. You get into a rut sometimes, and that rut is insidious. And then it starts to kind of affect you, and it affects your reports, and affects the way you see patients. You start to kind of say the same thing over and over. Maybe you make a macro and just say macro this. And, you know, at the end of the day, you go home. And I think that one of the things that we should be asking ourselves when we go home is, how do you feel? Not what did you think? The thinking part gets too influenced by other things. Just, how do you feel? And that's when I really started to realize that I was burning out. Because I would leave tired. I would sit in my car when I got home and just sit in there for like 10 minutes before walking in. And that was obviously kind of what I think is red needle burnout, but you might find it even in your own practice. At first it's fun, and then you start to find it's a little bit more onerous, a little bit less interesting. Especially the other things that I started noticing was oncology imaging started to take over. And although it's important and it can be very interesting, a lot of it is measuring. And over a while, you just kind of start going, God, I don't see much of the lung diseases that kind of get me going. I seem to be measuring a lot of nodules and looking for complications. And that was another thing that kind of wore me down. So that's kind of where I am at this point. But like I say, I'm a lot happier now. I enjoy the people I work. I read for the U.S., which is kind of fun. And it's really been enjoyable talking to the ER physicians and the ICU docs in the communities where they don't have specialists. Now, these people are very appreciative of everything you have to offer. And I kind of miss that. You know, you kind of hang up the phone and go, God, that was nice. That was nice.
That's so interesting. Yeah, a lot of people, I've met some people who went from private practice to academics, and they typically said, oh, in private practice, you're sort of reading way more studies, and so it's nice to kind of have the buffer and teach and stuff like that and in the academic setting. But you're sort of saying that you were so specialized within academics, and you had this specialized knowledge that wasn't being fully appreciated by the people you were sharing it with, and that plus the fact that you didn't get as much variety. Is that kind of also what you're saying? Like now you have more variety and more appreciation in what you're doing. It's interesting.
It's happening to a lot of centers. Like they develop these big things like, oh, this is going to be an oncology center. This is going to be a big, you know, cardiac center or something. And you start to read a lot more of those. And at first it's interesting, but then you start, I'm kind of missing some of the other things. Like oddly enough, one of the things I really enjoyed when I went to Vision was relearning neuro and body. And it came back to me. It's like, geez, that's what I loved about residency. You know, you at night, you're skipping around doing all sorts of things, OB, peds, and then a trauma, then a head CT. So I kind of missed that, because one of the big reasons I chose radiology is because I liked all the fields, but I love the intellectual side, but I liked kind of learning about all of them. And it's kind of like a family practice of subspecialties when you do it that way. So, yeah. And, you know, I had a lot of panic attacks making the transition. Like, what am I doing? But, you know, we all learn. We all got through medical school. You can learn this again. And, you know, I'm still learning.
You mentioned being a resident. And you were previously a residency program director. I'm curious, what was your experience like as a program director, and particularly in terms of like the challenges that you faced and that radiology residents then and now face?
Yeah, that was a longer time ago, and it was a little different. The administrative duties were quite a lot, but nothing like they are now, which is pretty much, if you're a residency director, most of it is actually administrative stuff. And I did not find that real interesting. The other thing I found also interesting as program director is that we had so many really good residents at the time, but there were a few who were struggling, and they struggled because of various issues. And you find that you have to spend most of your time with them. You'd like to be with the others and you get time with them, but you really, it's your responsibility to help these people get, they have the talent, they just need changes in their personal approach or the perceptual skills or something. And but I think what ultimately got me was, even though it was nothing like it is now, it was the administration. It was so much paperwork. And what I saw was each year I did it, it seemed to exponentially rise. And so when I got to OHSU, you know, I would talk with the program director there, but yeah, that's what they did. They didn't seem to mind it as much. I didn't find it interesting.
What you said about the teaching, being a residency program director and spending most of your time with the residents who were struggling, that I was a teacher for a while, and 1000% that was my experience as a teacher. There are some people who are really getting it and really excited about it. And even the people who, you know, some of the goofballs who aren't necessarily paying attention, like some of them were really smart and kind of got it, but you're spending all of your time on the couple of students who were struggling for this reason or that reason. And it brings up an interesting topic. We weren't really planning on going here, but I feel like this, you know, is education a strong link problem or a weak link problem? In the sense that, is the goal of education to make sure that people don't go below a certain level? Or are you defined by the student who's doing the worst? Or are you defined by the student who is able to do the best? And I think that there's some like interesting texture in there about like science in general and education in general, as far as like what process we're really engaged with. And I feel like sometimes we're sort of alternating between them, but it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I've gone to a lot of the residency program radiology meetings in the ECR, and there were lots of different takes. I just I grew up as a distance runner. I had college paid for that way, and I was a big team person with that. I liked to try and get the runners who I could see. They had talent, but they just weren't exerting it, right? They get distracted too much, and to try to get them higher up so the team actually finishes higher. And that's kind of how I approached it as a program director. It's like, yeah, you can define me as our couple here who are 99th percentile, or you can define me as the ones who are in the 70th. But what I want to see is like all of us can do the job and we all try really hard and we do it as a team. And, I was the coach essentially, but it did wear on me a bit. So, but I did find that most of my time was spent with these kids, and that was all right. They were really nice people too. They just had some difficulties. But yeah, what we define education, I don't know what the metric is. I think they change it anyway. So
before we started recording this, we were talking a little bit about overdiagnosis. And it's a topic that particularly in radiology, we see a lot of. We also see underdiagnosis too, but we see a lot of overdiagnosis. What is your take on overdiagnosis, particularly from a radiologic perspective?
Yeah, the radiology perspective on this is, I personally think it's rampant. And imaging is a huge area where overdiagnosis is being done. Yes, there are some that are underdiagnosed. There's no perfect, right? ROC curve and sensitivity, specificity. But what I've noticed is we as radiologists, I don't know if it's the fact that it's the workload or you get tired, but you just tend to say things. And these little things have a huge downstream effect on some people. For instance, if you say degenerative disc disease, workman's comp physical physicians will get an increase in the amount of people coming to them. Our physical rehab doctor came to me because we were working on the curriculum, the basic science curriculum together, and he mentioned that. And he says, the patients walk around with a little sticker, say, I have degenerative disc disease. Now, we don't think anything of it, but just that. So now I just say age-related spine changes or something like that. Saying the term COPD, that's said all the time. That has ramifications. Maybe they have it. But, at the University of Utah, every Thursday afternoon was a clinic for patients who lost their insurance. And 9 out of 10 times, it was because the word COPD was there and they said they weren't a smoker. And the insurance company took away their insurance because they lied, because the doctor and the radiologist said it. Not understanding that there are other things like tracheal bronchomalacia and constrictive bronchiolitis that have nothing to do with smoking, but are pretty common, but we don't tend to teach them in our curriculum. So we tend to slide to a lower kind of report level and say findings consistent with COPD. Huge one, false positives for pulmonary emboli. I'll be talking about that in an upcoming lecture. But it's rampant. You got to know the ramifications when you call an embolus and there isn't one there. Okay, now the patient has got that in their Epic chart. Now they're going on anticoagulation with its risks. Now they have recurrent doctor's visits because of that. What happens to their insurance? What happens when they come to the ER next time and they say they have chest pain? What do you think they're going to get? Yeah, they're going to get a hematology workup too. So all of this starts to add up to complications of the wallet. And complications of the wallet per patient are huge. So again, how sure are you there's an embolus? If you're not, best not to call it. I know the traditional teaching. I'm aware of what is taught. I don't want to miss it. The next one could kill you. By the way, I couldn't find any literature to support that latter argument. Next one can kill you. That's the lung doing its job, right? It stops the clot. You don't want the clot going elsewhere. The lung is kept alive by the bronchiolateries. Its job is to take away the clot so it doesn't go to the other side where it can do some serious damage. And we don't tend to teach that. We just teach you don't want to miss it. Now, there's a number of physicians all across specialties, not just in radiology, but in the ER too. There's a couple of just wonderful physicians who have written articles, the 7-step program to reducing your reliance on the CT. You're not going to catch every MS. In fact, it's better if you didn't, because we're probably doing more harm. Now, what is it about this overdiagnosis? It's because a lot of these are small emboli, and they just go to the lung. The lung will chop it up. But if you now start them on anticoagulation and all of these other things, these downstream complications occur. When I was a resident, a very wise radiologist said it's the rolling ball theory. Once we, as a radiologist, say something like this, we have now pushed the ball down the hill. Now, this ball is going to gain momentum, and it's almost impossible to stop. And you've got to be a little careful. Like I, when I teach other radiologists and stuff, it's like, you know, look at this exam. Look at this. Is this an embolus? Is this an in situ thrombus? Is this an artifact? That's all we got. We have no right heart strain. Do you want to push the ball? Because once you push it, it's going and it's hard to stop. And, you know, someone's mom or dad or kid, and, you know, I mean, what are we doing here? And it gets hard, because I know the reality too is there are so many examinations that you're expected to get through, and you got to get through it. And it's hard, so difficult to know all of these subtle things in all these different specialties. You're reading across the board, you know? So that's a big one. There are many other ones. Like, I started to notice another one that was really common, and it's a radiologist who will read a chest CT or a CTA, and they'll say, you know, there's a thyroid nodule, get an ultrasound if clinically indicated. And that line, that phrase, seemed to be almost like macroed in every one of these. So I started to look into that while I was at OHSU, and I did follow-ups, and they did get ultrasounds, and a number of them got biopsies. Okay, now, you know, I mean, this is, you know, we're moving into another direction here. Ball has been pushed. Hopefully it stops. But a number were found to have papillary carcinoma. And then they're referred to the ENT surgeon. Then they get, you know, consulted. Most of them go on to surgery, which you don't want surgery in the neck. You know, I mean, you just want to avoid it if you can, because you got lots of crucial structures here in a limited space. And I started also to notice that just because of that line, some of these patients, yeah, now their thyroid's out. Now they have a history of thyroid cancer. In fact, geez, I just read one the other night, and that's exactly what the ER said. I wasn't going to get this, but I got the chest and pelvis because they got a history of papillary carcinoma of the thyroid. And I'm like, oh my God, this cancer shouldn't really be called a cancer. People don't die with it. It's an overdiagnosis. And what overdiagnosis means is, yes, they have the disease, but they die with it. It would not cause any problems. Now, it's tough to know which one of these is an overdiagnosis, because you only fully know when the patient dies and they died of heart disease. Well, yeah, that was an overdiagnosis. And that's why overdiagnosis is not often emphasized in our curriculum or in epidemiology or in the studies. False positives are often mentioned because we can usually figure out if something's a false positive in a short period of time, and then we would put that in the literature. But overdiagnosis, patient has to die before you'd know. So there are very few studies that actually address that. Thyroid, though, is one of them. And it is such a common tumor that when you look at the autopsy series, again, when I have questions, the literature I tend to look at most closely is the pathology literature. And not a lot of people look at that, but that's where a lot of the answers are. And in the pathology literature, they've done studies where they do autopsies and someone dies of something, but they said, for the next year, we're going to look at every thyroid and cut it up and take a look. And they found that anywhere, depends on how thin it was, 36 to 50% of these patients had papillary carcinoma, that it was so common that many of the pathologists did not even mention it in the report because they considered it a normal variant. But we spend a lot of money and time looking for this and trying to treat it. So, you know, some people do die, but it's a very, very small number. And based on some of the ENT literature, you can usually tell who that's going to be in your first scan. There'll be a thyroid nodule, but there'll be some lymph nodes all around it or something else about it that says this one might need to be looked at closely. But when you have a thyroid with just a nodule in it with no lymph nodes, are you doing the patient a favor by saying it? Or are you practicing medicine that is you're trying to protect yourself? Now, that is a tougher question to answer too. If someone's been sued before, that's a horrible experience. Maybe they just, the hell with it. I'm just going to say it. You know, I'm just going to say it. I don't want to get sued anymore. But in the end, you kind of always remind yourself, this is someone's mom or dad. If you roll this ball, what is the likely destination of this ball? Will it stop or will it just keep running down and a whole host of other issues come up? And that's where I get with overdiagnosis. I've actually seen lung cancers that I say, just take it out. Don't even bother with the PET scan. Just take it out. And the patients live for 13 more years and die of heart disease. And they get scanned every 6 months, but they refuse treatment. I wouldn't recommend that at all. But it also makes me more humble. When I hear a physician say a colonoscopy, and we got your papilloma or we got your tumor, we got it early, we saved your life, I'm sorry, that's hubris. That's hubris. You don't know. You don't know. Hopefully it did. Maybe this was the right thing to do. To me, when we, you know, when a tumor is removed, you say, well, it's gone. The best we know will follow. But, you know, hopefully that this was a cure. And you got to have that humility. I've actually seen lung cancers disappear. Small cell. Adenocarcinoma. Patients, I mean, I wouldn't recommend it, but how often does it happen? I don't know. I've definitely seen it on multiple occasions. And this is rare situations in which there's the diagnosis, the patient refuses treatment. Most, you know, vast majority are just going to die. Some don't. It's just a humility. Don't just assume that we do this, we do it, it's going to, it, we're helping them. We probably are, but we don't know that. And, you know, things like thyroid cancer and colon cancer, like colonoscopy screening, there's no other country that does this. Why do we do it?
Yeah, well, you're referring to that Nordic study from that came out, I think it was it last year or the year before? But before we keep going on this, I just want to clarify something. So what is it that you actually do when you come across a filling defect in a pulmonary artery, you know, a sub-segmental artery or a thyroid nodule? Like, what are you... Okay. You know, are you saying that those are, I mean, thyroid nodules, maybe not, but like maybe I know that there are certain things that can fool you into thinking that it's actually a filling defect, but it's actually not. It's from the bronchial artery or a lymph mm-hmm. node or something like that, or there's motion artifact. But I guess just to clarify exactly what you're saying about the pulmonary embolus.
Yeah, with the pulmonary embolus, I'm really careful if I call it. And I make sure, and if I'm not sure, I'm not afraid to say this is an indeterminate. and an in situ thrombus might be more likely, or this is mixing artifact. There's no expansion of the vessel. There's no right heart strain. There's no other lesions. The other, I tried for about a number of years at OHSU just to say, incidentally noted is an isolated subsegmental embolus. And they found they still treated them. Renal failure patients. Oh my God. Dialysis patients. Oh my God. You don't want to scan their chest because the fistulas all have thrombus and the thing. So they all go off. And of course, what's the function of the lung? Well, it catches the thrombus and it'll chop it up and recycle it. But you go and call that an embolus. And I've seen that a number of times. And they get started in anticoagulation. And for renal failure patients, that's generally a very good idea. And I've seen catastrophic things happen. So I just say it's indeterminate if I'm not sure. If I don't see expansion and I don't see any right heart strain or any infarct, then really, what are we treating? The other thing you can use, and I've used this, is that I, you know, that might be an embolus or a thrombus. I favor it's not. However, you could do lower extremity ultrasounds. Now, what if that's negative? Well, that still could be an embolus, right? Well, who cares? What's the whole purpose of this anticoagulation, which, by the way, I don't even think that works that well. What's the whole purpose of that thing? Oh, you want to prevent the next one. Well, what if there's nothing there? Then you, what are you treating? You're treating this? This is going to take care of it. The lung, the capillary endothelium in the lung has all sorts of fibrolytic enzymes that chop things up. That's its job. I mean, DVTs, they all go to the lung, whether you anticoagulate or not. There's not a lot of fibrolytic enzymes there. It's wound healing. There's a wonderful study that's been done that I'm sure no one read. It looks at the electron microscopy evolution of a clot. And it's exactly the same as if you cut your skin. It's all the same. It is an inflammatory process that actually monocytes and macrophages get into the clot. It's not a fibrolytic. And then when it breaks the pieces, where do the pieces go? Goes downstream to the lung. In the lung, it catches it. There are the fibrolytic enzymes and you recycle it. So if you find a lesion, say, well, I think that could be a thrombus, you could suggest, you know, favor this is not. However, bilateral lower extremity ultrasound to assess if there is any treatable DVT. And you can just leave it at that. Now, I don't like doing it because it's another study, but if it saves a patient from getting a diagnosis of pulmonary embolus and all of the downstream ramifications, then in that case, I think personally that that would be worth it.
I'm going to have to ask a dumb question here in terms of the distinction between pulmonary embolus, so a clot formed somewhere else traveling to the lung, versus in situ, in situ, a clot forming within the lung in terms of treatment. I did not realize that these were going to be treated differently and the data behind treating PE with anticoagulation versus in situ thrombus, let it be.
Yeah, this is absolutely not a dumb question. And you know what the answer is? We don't know. So the reason I bring it up is because how often have you been taught that a filling defect could be an in situ thrombus?
Never.
And this is not unique. So again, this is, what is our privilege? Our privilege is that we get to look inside people. And then we start to look at this and I go, wait a minute, this is not branching. This is just one little linear filling defect that's in the setting of consolidation or ground glass around it. And I learned about this. Guess from whom? It was the pathologist. Always go to the pathologist. And they say, yeah, diffuse alveolar damage, that's ARDS. In situ thrombus is part of the injury. This is a wound healing process too. And these small little arterioles and venules develop thrombus. And sometimes the thrombi can propagate back enough where our CT scanners can now see them. And our teaching is that's an embolus. How do you distinguish it? I don't know. No one's really ever talked about it. In fact, we just published a paper in AJR this past, I don't remember, April or so, where we actually wrote about it. In situ thrombus, something that's not taught. And we went through all the different types. And just so people were aware that it was out there. And then I just offered a hypothesis. And that's all this is. An embolus that comes from downstream oftentimes will branch at a bifurcation. But an in situ thrombus usually doesn't branch. An embolus often will cause some expansion of a vessel in the acute setting. And in situ thrombus won't. Whether you treat it or not, you go to the pathology literature, and what they say is, no, there is no association with anticoagulation improvement. This is a wound healing process. COVID really brought this to life. A lot of the patients who had diagnosed pulmonary embolus actually were probably in situ thrombus. There was a paper that was published looking at, in the pathology data, looking at autopsies in the lungs on all these patients who died in New York and Italy early on. And what they found was 8 out of 10 of them had in situ thrombus. And half of those, almost half, the in situ thrombus propagated back to a visualized vessel. They found that, they said, this is part of the COVID acute lung injury, diffuse subular damage. And, you know, this does not, it's not an anticoagulation responsive thing. It's just part of the wound healing. This will eventually resolve. Just like when you cut yourself, you will get a clot here, right? And that clot will eventually get reabsorbed and healed over. So we don't teach about in situ thrombus. We don't understand its instance. No one's really ever studied it other than the pathologists have data on it that we try to extrapolate. But it's not a dumb question. It's how do you tell the difference? And again, what I ended up doing with the COVID patients, because I found a paper where it said the bleeding complications of COVID with anticoagulation was just as high as the so-called thromboembolic events. But again, a lot of these thromboembolic events are probably in situ thrombus and not events at all, but expected. So the hematologist friend of mine, very good, he says, a lot of people don't understand when you are, say, a hypercoagulable state, you also have a propensity to bleed. So it's kind of like the coagulation system has gone awry. So you're hypercoagulable, you go on anticoagulation, but you also have a propensity to bleed. So the risks are not, you know, that low. So how do you tell? And when I teach it, I just say, look, I think this is an in situ thrombus. I've saw so many COVID patients during that period of time when everyone was ending up in a respirator. And a lot of them had small thrombi. They were just in the area of the acute lung injury. They didn't branch. There was no expansion. And there was no, you know, no right heart strain. So I just went, well, I think this is in situ thrombi. So why don't you just take a look in the legs? Again, going back. And then what I started to hear, which was distressing, was it doesn't matter because now there was a pulmonologist or someone who published the paper and said we should treat all patients with COVID and elevated D-dimer with anticoagulation. Now, why is the D-dimer elevated in these patients with ARDS and acute lung injury? Well, it's because they have in situ thrombus. So they, by definition, they will be elevated. And so again, the people who wrote this, the so-called experts, and made those recommendations, did not know this either. This is what I love about medicine, right? We all can contribute and we can look. Will we change anything? I don't know. Probably not. But you start to realize, again, just like the last years at OHSU, when I started to watch and say, I think this is not a good idea for the patient. I really, really think that we shouldn't be doing this. And it's ignored. And so when COVID came around, it's like, I really think you shouldn't be giving this person anticoagulation. But it was ignored. Thankfully, some of the community physicians, they were very interested in it. And I emailed them the pathology papers and stuff so they could see it. But the people who make the recommendations, like, I think it's, for me, it would be an insult to call me an expert. Freakonomics was an interesting book. And they said, an expert is someone so tightly tied to what they teach that they ignore contrary observations. And I've seen that. So I never want to be called an expert, just a person with a high curiosity and a willingness to evolve or change as you learn more. And to say, well, I was wrong on that one. Well, we all were, but you know, I'm not going to teach that anymore for sure. So these are some of the things that you can do. Is for the thyroid nodule, I just say incidental 1 centimeter thyroid nodule, period. I leave it at that. If I see lymph nodes or I see something a little bit unusual about it, I'll push the ball down the hill and get it going. So I'm not trying to minimize this stuff. I don't want to be dangerous. I don't want to miss somebody, you know, try to an opportunity to help. But I'm also very, very aware of the harms that we can do by just being very casual about this. Hopefully, did I explain that well enough? The in situ thrombus, by the way, look for it, gang. And you'll see it in regular ARDS patients too, if you look hard enough. And if you don't believe me, go spend some time with a lung pathologist. They will tell you all of this.
So one question that we typically ask at the end of every interview that we do, which I'm going to just ask now because I think you are a fount of this type of answers to this question. But the question we always ask is, what are some medical truths that very few of your colleagues agree with you on? So you've given us a few, and I'm just sort of curious, any other ones that come to mind that we could pick your brain about?
Yeah, you're going to think I'm crazy on this one. I don't think pulmonary emboli require anticoagulation for the most part. The study from 1961 from Barrett and all was the so-called gold standard paper that the Cochrane Library rejected. It was a terrible paper. And we have embraced this idea that anticoagulation is good. The papers that show that, oh, DVTs will progress if you don't treat them, that's papers that people got started on anticoagulation and then were taken off it after, say, a week or a month or so. And the body has a homeostasis. So if you anticoagulate, the body is saying, oh, I've got to rev up the coagulation cascade, and then you suddenly remove it and you got a thrombus there, it will propagate. But Nelson et al. In 1994, I don't know how they got it through IRB, did a study where they had healthy patients with DVTs above the knee, and they randomized them to absolutely no treatment at all, placebo, and anticoagulation. And what they found was the DVT progression rate was the same. The DVD progression rate was the same. The silent emboli were the same. One died of an embolus, and that was in the treated group. And so you start to realize that this should be a question that needs to be reevaluated, just like what you believe is that we should be studying things as we get more information, rather than just a setting for dogma. Dogma is, this is the teaching, we know it, and it should not be questioned. Yet we as radiologists, we look and we see, and you're like, this really should be re-questioned. It turns out a lot of the right heart strain is pulmonary vasoconstriction. And that's where it's not necessarily clot burden. Now, there are multiple studies that say, oh, you know, the clinician says, well, I'm worried about a big one. And it's like, clot burden is not associated with right heart strain. That's been shown with a number of images or a number of studies. It's another player. Like, did you ever wonder, like, were you taught not to start someone in the old days on Coumadin? That you had to bridge with IV heparin. Were you taught that? Do you remember the reason given for that you were told?
Yeah, it had to do with like blocking certain factors first, S or C or something.
C and S, yeah.
Yeah. And that those, so it becomes the, it does the opposite at first rather than, yeah.
Has there been a study to show that?
I have no idea.
So it's made up, right? And so we make up a lot of stuff. And one of the things is IV heparin and IV Lovenox. And I didn't know this until I talked with the pediatric ICU doctor, is a pulmonary artery vasodilator. It's a potent pulmonary artery vasodilator. How do you die from a pulmonary embolus? Massive vasoconstriction, right heart strain, you know, arrhythmia, death. So you IV heparin, you've now addressed the pulmonary vasodilation, and now you switch over to Coumadin. Coumadin does not address that. And so that's how the risk is. Is that true? I think it's, I think that hypothesis is very true. Again, the book about what we don't know in medicine is bigger than the book that we do know. We be humble. Another one, cachexia with emphysema. What? The patient can't eat enough? Who made that up? I mean, come on. Let's at least pretend we did basic science. Let's at least pretend it. And you have an intrathoracic cavity that is hyperinflated with high pressures. The heart is compressed. You can go look at this yourself. And the right atrial pressures are high. How does venous blood get back in? It relies on the diaphragmatic excursion and the negative pressures. It accentuates. That's how transient interruption of contrast occurs. In these patients, there's no diaphragmatic excursion. The pressures are high and they can't increase the venous flow back. You eat a meal, the splenic artery flow increases, but not the venous. I know you guys don't do mesenteric angiograms, the conventional ones anymore much. We used to do them all the time. And on these patients, when we would inject the splenic artery, the SMA, it would go through and then I would see it going in the SMB and this is what it's doing. I'm like, how is this patient alive? And you see it and you just like, what? What? This is the problem. They get mesenteric ischemia from the venous side and they can't eat that much. They lose weight. It's a great hypothesis. Has anyone tested it? No. No, but, you know, not a lot of agreement there. You know, there's all sorts of things that, like mediastinal widening, I think you shouldn't ever say it in your reports. It leads to clinicians to tighten their sphincter. And when that sphincter tightens, ordering starts to occur. Leave it out. Is the mediastinum concerning for a hematoma or great vessel injury? Then say that. Is the mediastinum concerning for adenopathy or mass because of the density and mass effects? Say that. If it's just large and the density is normal and fat and you can see the arch well, then, you know, it's probably lipid, you know, lipomatosis. It's probably the rotated to the right. You know, there's other explanations. You know, why is the thoracic aorta become tortuous with age? I hear a lot of interesting ones. Have you? Hypertension, lack of compliance. What? No, they're kyphotic. The roof is coming down. Why are you people making this stuff up? You see, this is all of this stuff is right there in front of us. Can you tell a pericardial effusion or an anterior mediastinal hematoma on a chest radiograph? Yeah. Yeah, sometimes you can. If there's a swan there, or if there's a drain, or there's a pacer, and now the right atrium is very thin, but now it seems like the right atrium's here. Okay, now that's a pericardial effusion or an anterior mediastinal hematoma or something else. It needs an explanation. So all of these things that we teach and I teach, I try to be transparent with it. I try to show the examples where there's literature. I try things like in situ thrombus are tough because you can only look at the pathology literature because no one teaches it. But there's a lot of things that people do and teach that I think are incorrect or at least partially incorrect. Not to saying mine is, because you know, might learn something new in the near future that, oh, this anticoagulation works pretty well. Maybe we should do that. But right now, if I had a pulmonary embolus, I'd probably take sildenafil. You know, it's a pulmonary artery vasodilator.
Yeah. So you, when you were saying that, you mentioned something that that we were talking about before the interview, which is one medical truth that I believe that I don't know if many of my colleagues would agree with me on, is that all medical evidence should come with an expiration date. And at some point, it needs to be reevaluated to see if it's true. There's so many examples of this being important. There are sometimes where we actually do this, like with aspirin for primary prevention of heart attack. They finally reevaluated that, and lo and behold, it doesn't help, and probably it has to do with all the other advancements that we've made. But I feel this way strongly about COVID treatments as well, that we have all this great evidence from 2020, 2021, when COVID was in many ways a different disease than it is now. We have COVID 2024 now, not COVID-19. And, you know, do these treatments all work for COVID 2024? I mean, maybe, but I think it's definitely an open question in my mind, whether that's the case.
I mean, I love that theory. I think it should be part of medicine that the expiration date idea is perfect, because getting a study now through an IRB, once it's been labeled, quote unquote, and this is another thing I can't stand. Standard of care. What do you mean when you say that? Like sociologists, when you look up pluralistic ignorance, that's what it is. Well, I'm not sure where it is, but everyone's doing it. And so that's what's accepted. Pluralistic ignorance, according to sociologists, you're in a situation where you don't know what to do. So you look at what everyone's doing and then you do it. If you've been with a physician who says we're doing this because of this study, which this patient seems to fit, that's different. But you say standard care, I know you don't know where it came from. I know you just told me you don't know where it came from. And this doesn't work for me. And I think that, you know, this standard care also blocks these IRB to reevaluate. And they should be reevaluated. There's a lot of things that we do that should be reevaluated. I wish that worked, but standard of care. You know, I actually had a litigation lawyers come and talk at the medical school. They defend doctors. Yeah, standing room only. You know what they put? The first slide was, why will the patient sue you? 1 through 49, they don't like you. They don't like you. Yeah, you talked with them. You looked at their watch. Oh, that was picked up. That was picked up. And they just said it over and over and over again. It's like people say, oh, well, you cover your ass. You got to do the standard care. No, be nice. Listen, just watch what happens and be transparent. But again, I understand physicians, they are overworked. They don't have any time for the patients. And if they did do that for every patient, they would be there till midnight finishing the reports. So I understand. But in the end, from the litigation lawyer's point of view who defend doctors, that is almost always the reason.
That's very interesting. I would totally buy that. I think that is also why a lot of hospital lawyers have transitioned on the whole admitting fault when a medical mistake occurs. Like it used to be, don't say anything, separate yourself, don't interact with the patient. But now what they recommend you do if you do make a medical error is go admit it to the patient, apologize, explain what happened. And I think probably the reason that they've changed their tune on that is because they see that being beneficial in the long term for their lawsuits. I don't think they're changing for moral reasons. But it, ironically, I don't think that's going to work for radiologists getting sued because we don't meet our patients.
That is a huge disadvantage of being a radiologist. It's a huge disadvantage. Yeah, we don't get to see them. And so we are just a name with this huge price tag that we only see, you know, a couple dollars of, but, you know, the hospital takes most of it. But it's a problem. Yeah, we are. And that's, and the other thing is we do tend to get fingered out a lot because it's hard to hide from missing something on imaging, right? So, because then the clinician can say, oh, they didn't have peritoneal signs when I examined them. Well, you can't really prove it, but it's like, oh, there wasn't a nodule there. Oh, no. What's that?
One of the topics we were talking about a little bit before this was overdiagnosis. And I guess, well, I guess the flip side of overdiagnosis is underdiagnosis. But one of the problems that you were talking about is in radiology is being overworked, having too many studies. And I want to get your thoughts on the amount of imaging that is now ordered. And as a result, some radiologist, or, you know, maybe in the future, a computer algorithm, but for now, somebody as a radiologist has to look at about just an increased number of imaging. And I bring this up because, and this may just be me being an R1 and being extremely frustrated, but at my institution, we have to protocol all of the studies that come in. And the problem with it is we can't say no. We can't be like, this is a dumb thing to do. Like, we can't be like, it's like, I have to look at it. I have to click a button. But, you know, it's like, oh, like this patient, the, you know, they got a CT of their head for subconjunctival hemorrhage. And you're like, that makes no sense. Like, I can't hit the no button. So I guess I'm curious, like, if radiologists really want to take more of a role in, like a patient-centered role in management, should we be more of doing what the insurers are doing and denying studies?
God, that's a great topic. What you've talked about, I propagated really aggressively for early years. And I kept saying, you give this away and we will pay for it. And it was given away because you just made more money. One radiologist who I really like said, I fought this tooth and nail. And what I found was the clinicians just got fed up with me and did it anyway. So now I just say, sure, we can do it. And they just shove the money in my pants. That's the quote. And I was very disheartened, but I understood. I mean, because I could see it. So I tried it and it was difficult. The reason why I thought that's what we did is because, again, I trained in Canada. And up there in radiology, when you take your radiology boards, it is a ton of clinical. You have to know that because you have the right to say no. You say no, and that's done. They'll be mad at you, but no. Most countries, that's what it is, but not in America. Here we sit and just protocol and protocol and protocol and read and read and read. And we are wearing ourselves down. We get into decision-making fatigue very early. That's when the point where the mind just, you don't even know what to say anymore. You've been doing this for the last number of hours. But I don't think that's going to change because these are established. And the other thing is, in order to take that back, you do have to put the clinical in that education of a radiology residency. You know, like, what are the symptoms of a pulmonary embolus? Shortness of breath. Chest pain is rare. Hemoptysis, no, that's a myth. That's very, very uncommon. You know, all of these things, you have to know that. And so then when you hear this from the clinician, they have, you know, this, and you're like, no, this is a TIA. No, no, we didn't image TIAs in Canada. And the clinician wouldn't even order it. They would get worked up and you know, they'd look very closely at the carotids like the next day or something. But, you know, that was what they did. Now, I don't know if that's what they do now. That was a long time ago. But that's how it was. And I remember clinicians coming down to the reading room in Canada, and they would state their what the patient has, and the radiologist listened and go, no, that's not indicated. And that was it. So I got kind of shocked a bit by when I got back to the States about how often things just get ordered and it's like, this isn't required. Well, we're not really interested in your opinion. Just read it. You know? And you're like, oh, we're going to start the burnout now. Thousands and thousands of minute betrayals of purpose. What am I here for? You know, that sort of thing. What volume you all are doing now is much, much higher even than what I did. I don't know how you're going to do it. The other thing is that you're also in a system that measures RVUs. I don't know if you know what that is. It's not good. It is based on Taylorism. William Taylor in the 1870s was hired back in the day by textile workers, owners, textile factory owners, to find out what was a reasonable day's work for pay. And so William Taylor took this project on, hired his own people, paid them twice the amount of money, and measured their output based on a metric. And then he would submit this to the factory owners. This is what you can expect these people can actually do. And so then people started working even harder because they had to meet this quota. And if they didn't, they got fired. And then you hire the next person. That's called Taylorism. And that has made its way into medicine. Now we have a metric of RVUs. Are you up to this level? And even in academics, that was addressed, which kind of sucked for me because I was doing cardiopulmonary, which is a low reimbursement, as opposed to, say, something like neuro and musculoskeletal, which is a high reimbursement. So, but, you know, this is the world. If you wanted to see what that's like, you could always try and go do a away rotation in Canada or England.
The only way that I could, like, envision any semblance of radiologists getting a say in what happens or doesn't happen is actually taking on the role of an insurer. And by that, I mean like a company like Kaiser, where the payer, where you have the payer and the organization providing care are the same organization. So there's like incentives built in to reduce costs. Now, I don't think it would make sense in like an emergent circumstance. Like, I feel like that would be a harder sell, but for like routine outpatient imaging, like, I just have to say one more. I think I told Daniel this, but the other day I was protocoling like an abdominal CT, and it was a female patient in her 30s. And I like went and I looked at it, and it was like right lower quadrant pain for like 3 weeks, 2-3 weeks. And I read through the note, and I contacted the provider who ordered this. And I was like, you know, like, what are you concerned about? And the provider was like, oh, I think that there's, you know, I think that they have like something's going on with the uterus or the ovaries. And I said, well, you know, CT really is not the best way to look at it. You should definitely, you know, consider getting a pelvic ultrasound first. That would be my recommendation. And their comment was, well, I also want to rule out other things in the abdomen. And when I pressed them on this, and I was like, particularly with a patient that's young, we try to have as low as reasonably achievable levels of radiation. And they just ignored the advice. And got the CT for a 30-something-year-old anyhow. So I think that the only way to realistically change that would be if the incentive of the organization you were in was to cut down on imaging in order to improve the bottom line for the organization, rather than it being like helping an individual patient from unnecessary radiation exposure.
That's a really interesting thought. I had not considered that approach. I don't think it would work as well for the ER situation, it might, but yeah, for these outpatient ones, I think that that's very reasonable. It's interesting the answer you got. I've heard that one a lot. I like it when I hear I'm the one seeing the patient, and it's like, well, you know, what do you think we're doing? I mean, you're wondering what's going on inside the patient. I'm looking inside the patient and I'm telling you, this is why I'm seeing the patient. Well, I don't think you are seeing the patient. I don't think you're seeing them well. Or maybe it's something in between that we got to work through. But that sort of attitude, I don't particularly care about. Best clinicians I've ever met never have ever said that. If I see something that's discrepant, they go, very interesting. Oh, it's not matching. Could you be, you know, they want to know. But the clinician says, I'm the one seeing the patient. And I already know they're the standard of care physician. I don't really, it's a waste of time talking to them. And I feel for you because I think even with the insurance thing, it'll still be hard, but I like the idea. Believe me, I like the idea because you have to financially incentive it, but damn, that could be really hard. The other thing though, is that as what I do also worry is that when I talk to some other radiologists, I find their clinical knowledge is not as good as I think it could be. And that makes me worried to say, well, we don't think you need it. Well, are you really sure you understand this concept clinically? Because if not, maybe you shouldn't be kind of giving them the Heisman, so to speak. It's hard. Practicing medicine is really, really difficult to do well. And I think that's why a lot of people eventually give up. I know I've seen a lot of radiology residents in my time. They're idealistic. And then by the end, they just don't fight it. They just read it. They just say kind of macro this and they move on and go home. And it's too bad. It, you know, but how many times does that happen to surgery residents or neurosurgery residents or hospitalists? I mean, it's the same for them. ER doctors, you know, it's the same for them. They just, you can beat down after a while. I mean, some of those ER doctors see way too many patients. They don't want to see them, but they get made to. And then best of all, the patient gets to rank them. Yeah, I'm like, what? They come into you, they lie to you, and then they told you you were a lousy doctor, and then you get called into human resources for this? Oh my God, I wouldn't practice that either. So as much as sometimes the radiology, it's really hard out there for them. And it's good to have that sort of understanding when you're talking to them that, man, yeah, they got it a little tougher than us on many occasions. So try to be sympathetic and helpful. At least that's what I found with the community docs. They're very
The emergency medicine docs, I think we can all agree they have it much worse than we do.
Oh, it's so bad. Every time I talk with them, I'm like, oh my God, how you make it?
All right, we have a couple of rapid fire questions for you. And then we'll wrap things up. So a question we ask everyone is, if you had unlimited funds for a randomized controlled trial or a study, what are you most interested in studying and what would that trial look like?
The big one would be not to anticoagulate pulmonary emboli and DVT and just find the subset group that would benefit. There's usually going to be a subset, but we haven't evaluated. It's an in situ thrombus, anticoagulation, large embolus with, thrombophilia. They get the same treatment. You can't treat them all the same, right? That's one. Oh, proving that pregnancy is not a hypercoagulable state. That'd be a fun one. Use of the thromboblast graft analyzer, show that they are not necessarily hypercoagulable because we scan way too many pregnant patients because of the guise of hypercoagulable. But that's based on studies that use surrogate endpoints of cascade changes. Oh, protein S is higher. Well, wait a minute. Everything changes in this setting, but their overall coagulation based on TEG, thromboblast graft analyzer, really isn't any different. What's another one? Oh, reevaluate statins. I think that those are escaping. Oh, and reevaluate colonoscopy.
Why statins?
I think that their side effects are a lot worse. If you've had a heart attack or so, sure, go for it. Where they've, I think that that is a, boy, that is something that if we live 50 years back, they may look back and go, boy, they were kind of crazy with that. They were giving them to everyone. And the side effects of those are not insignificant. And I'm not entirely convinced it's they're as good as what people say. I understand that they do do something with the endothelium stabilization. That's kind of how they work, but not the cholesterol, but the endothelium stabilization. But I don't know. I'm just radiologist. But again, I'm just kind of look at this and I look at the data and I talk to my epidemiology friends and they point out some statistical equations that were used in some of these studies that were just kind of like, yeah, might not be as good as what people say. If you had an MI, go for it. But maybe diabetic, but I mean, primary prevention, I mean, it makes people diabetic. Not a lot, but more than the number that will prevent an MI, a non-fatal MI. Which one would you, I mean, this is a complication, now you're diabetic. There's a whole bunch of other ones. I know that one's controversial. It really does. It gets people fired up. And I might be wrong, but I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. That would be a great study. Unlimited funds. Oh my God, there's a whole bunch of studies they would do.
Next question is, what is the most underrated article in medical literature that more physicians / radiologists should be aware of?
Wow, that's a tough one too. Okay. I actually would go with, not so much an article, but I would go with epidemiology. I would go with articles that discuss practical approaches to epidemiology, how not to ever use the relative risk when you're talking to people or when people talk to you and they give you a relative risk reduction or something. That's an intellectual way to lie in medicine. To learn how to use the absolute risk and number needed to treat, to talk to patients not as a risk benefit, but as a risk risk. What is the risk if you get a mammogram at 50? What is the risk if you do not? You put it on equal terms. And what I find is that physicians, when you say in risk benefit, there's an emphasis on the benefit. It's a subconscious way. I find the epidemiology understanding of physicians to be very poor. I've talked to really high level physicians and radiologists, and they give me this gold standard paper on why like chemoembolization is so good for hepatomas. And then I go look up the paper. It's a relative risk reduction, but when you do the calculations, the absolute risk was you needed to treat like 20 patients to save one quality year. And that's an average of three treatments for about, you know, $20,000 or something, $15,000. It was a lot. And you look and you're like, this, you know, this is not so impressive. Maybe it'll work. I'm sure there's a subset it's good for, but we're kind of applying it to all here. So any article or redoing epidemiology, but not necessarily learning about like odds ratios and things like that, because that tends to cloud us. We don't use that. Just things like who funded the study? What is the absolute relative? What's the absolute risk reduction number needed to treat? You gotta, if the paper doesn't tell you that, don't read it. What is the outcome? Surrogate outcomes. Doctors get that all. Statins, a lot of the articles were written on, well, everyone knows that cholesterol lowering will improve survival. Wait a minute, wait, time out. Now, Framingham didn't show that, but okay. We want to know the absolute survival or the risk, but that the cholesterol is easier and it's a surrogate endpoint. Weight loss versus health. yeah, you can be skinny and unhealthy. What you really want to have is an outcome is health. So these sort of things that physicians, we have control over that we can do. But when we talk, when papers are presented or discussed, these issues are not understood. And these are from the people who make, you know, some of them make the policies. I guess that would be my answer. Epidemiology, going back to it. If we say we practice evidence-based medicine, we should understand at least something about the evidence. And it's hard. It's confusing. That's why I have a lot of epidemiologist friends and Master's of Public Health students I have on speed dial. If I have a paper I don't understand, send it to them.
Speaking of epidemiology, there's a paper that I think came out in the last couple of years that I'm sure some of the supporters of this podcast, some people we've had on before who probably agree with many of your views on this, might object to the specific comment about diabetes and statins. And I'll just, this is from Andrew Foy, over a cardiologist over at a self-proclaimed medical conservative when it comes to medical use, who wrote this this article, came out a year ago. And basically, it looks at hundreds of thousands of patients, and it shows that statin use was strongly associated with incident diabetes when users were compared with non-users, but not when continuers were compared with discontinuers. So the message being that selection bias confounds the association between statin use and incident diabetes and observational studies. Not to say whether statins don't have other issues, but I think I'm not 100% sure that they cause diabetes. But who knows? I haven't looked into this
that,
deeply
well,
enough to know.
See, right? I'm not aware of that paper.
Yeah.
And that may be true. Like I said, when I say these things, this is based on what I understand now. New information comes out. If it really doesn't, like I do know, because I never could figure out, like, why does statin seem to be more effective in the diabetic patient and the post-MI? But yet, it could cause diabetes? That never really registered. So if it doesn't, I actually thought it might because it does interrupt that coenzyme A pathway in the liver so that it doesn't go to cholesterol, but it goes all the glycogen storage and stuff. And you could see, well, maybe that's a pathway. But if it doesn't, it doesn't. And like I said, there's a lot that we don't understand. I don't understand. But based on the knowledge and based on what I've learned, it's overprescribed to people. But I do know that it does seem to have that effect, beneficial effect on diabetic patients and on post-MI.
Mark, it was wonderful having you on the External Medicine Podcast. We hope you come back at some point, join us again, discuss new topics. For anyone who is a radiologist out there, Dr. Mark Goslin has some of the best lectures on MRI, MRI online. I don't know if it's MRIonline.com or
I think they call it Medley now.
Or whatever it is, go listen to his lectures. Yeah, great lectures. Fantastic. I've learned a lot from listening to you for many, 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 many hours. For people who are interested in learning more about you and your work and some of your interests, where should they go on the internet? Do you have a Twitter? Where can they find you?
Just through the email. Just the email. Goslin@ohsu.edu. I can always send a message. I still try to give lots of talks. I'm actually scheduled to give a free noon lecture, MRI online, March 7th, in a couple of weeks. So I try to get on and get as much stuff out there that doesn't require money. Because information and knowledge should be available. And the goal is always to give you a different perspective. And yeah, and if something I said doesn't seem right, let me be transparent with it. And if you ever want me back, just let me know. I have a lot of other topics.
We know. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and you guys have a wonderful evening.
and entertainment purposes only. We do not endorse any healthcare providers or treatments. Our views do not represent the views of any official organization or institution.
If you'd like to support us, subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, preferably a phenomenal review. Visit us at externalmedicinepodcast.com and tell your friends.